The Golden Door. "Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp," cries she, with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the Golden Door." Emma Lazarus, The New Colossus, inscribed at the Statue of Liberty. Frank was heir to the vision of Dr. Richard M. Buck, author of the 1901 book Cosmic Consciousness. He saw what Buck saw, knew what Buck knew, and like Buck, he had the intelligence, imagination, and courage to put the pieces together and envision a future in which we were all granted full and unrestricted access to our own internal dimensions. On the one hand, it sounds like the most obvious, desirable, and natural thing in the world, freedom. On the other hand, it sounds weirdly insane and dangerously radical. Heresy. Frank told me that he had always planned to write Cosmic Consciousness too, but he had the opposite problem that Buck had. Where it was probably all Buck could do to cobble together a handful of anecdotal cases, Frank was awash in a sea of lucid first-hand accounts, some under scientific conditions, some not, but no shortage of them that were cogent and powerful and unassailable. The real issue, he explained, isn't the one-time event, but lasting transformation, the permanent upliftment of the individual. Those cases, he said, were not so lavishly scattered, but could still be found. He didn't want to write just another rehash of the little revolution that couldn't. He wanted to carry on in the spirit of Bach and approach the subject with an almost childlike gladness, with a Christmas morning excitement, as if mankind's great present from God was sitting at our feet, wrapped in shiny paper with a perfect bow, just waiting for us to rip it open, and with it, ourselves. That was his dilemma. Childlike gladness was ill-received in the halls of academia. Christmas morning excitement doesn't pay the bills. Frank had a career to think about and a family to feed. He never wrote his book, so he'll have to settle for a few inadequate pages in mine. I can't make his argument for him, but the great frustration of his life was that he couldn't either. Frank wasn't at Harvard or Mill Brook with Leary or in the Redwoods or on the bus with Kesey or in jail with either of them, but he was there on the fringe somewhere, just starting out in his academic career, full of big ideas and a little revolutionary zeal. He was already familiar with Buck, Whitman, Thoreau, Emerson, and that bunch. He was already immersed in the mindset of an elevated humanity and convinced of its potential for upheaval. He understood and believed in what Buck called cosmic consciousness, but the problem, as he saw it, was one of access. What good was this wonderful faculty everyone supposedly possessed if no one could access it? What good is a door if you can't open it and go through? "It's not about the door or the wall or the key," he told me during one of our evening chats. "None of that. Those only matter on this side. The point is what's on the other side. The point is going there, being there. Then all this nonsense of doors and keys is forgotten." I agreed with him on that restating of the gateless gate paradox. The person who is free has no feeling of freedom any more than a person who is not on fire has a feeling of being not on fire. Freedom is a concept of the incarcerated mentality. It's something you think about when you're looking at windowless walls and locked doors. Once you're through and beyond, the very concepts of captivity and freedom recede out of existence behind you. So there was Frank in the late 50s and early 60s, staring at a wall he knew was a door, but a door he didn't know how to open. Maybe he'd been through it himself. But in selfless bodhisattva style, he wanted to throw it open for everyone. "Why shouldn't it be open?" he once asked me. "What the hell's the point of anything else if we don't have this?" Good question. And then, what to his wondering eyes should appear? The golden key. Very much a miracle and, to Frank's way of thinking, far more important than the discovery of fire or the invention of the wheel. As with his famous Harvard counterparts, the first keys he found out about were brass and tin, but they would soon be displaced by the true golden key, lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD, instant Buddhahood, free and easy access for everyone. The New World. That's what Frank called this dream of his. He thought America would be at the center of it, that this was the true freedom, and that ushering in a new era of fully realized human potential was America's promise and responsibility. That, to him, was the American dream, the Emersonian ideal, not a car in every garage and a chicken in every pot. Frank's new world was about a new tomorrow, not a continued downward spiral of greed, corruption, disease, and stultifying mediocrity. In the same way that having a clear vision of humanity's potential soured him on the current state of humanity, having a clear vision of America's potential disappointed him with regard to its current state. I think this might be one of the reasons he and Isabel bought their Mexico house years ago and vacationed here and ultimately retired here. Frank was quietly disgusted with the United States of America. He had a sad sort of disillusioned air about him. From our semi-boozy discussions, I was able to form a fairly clear picture of why. Simply, he was a patriot. He loved America. But the idea of America meant something to him that the reality of America didn't approach. It wasn't the place or the people he had such feelings for, but the idea. He wasn't a nationalist. He was a humanist and an idealist. He felt that America had a destiny it had failed to fulfill. He thought we were supposed to be venturing into new frontiers, not walling them off and plastering them over. He once likened his feelings for the U.S. to a son for whom one has the highest hopes and expectations, only to watch him grow into a common street thug and drug addict, beyond redemption, all potential wasted, all hope gone. He sadly echoed Lincoln's battlefield dream that this nation shall have a new birth of freedom. But what started out of the people, by the people, and for the people, he said, is now of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation. When I knew him, he still possessed a youthful dreaminess that most of us leave behind with our teens. An obstinate sort of optimism he had never outgrown. It's a good thing he liked to drink, or I might never have seen it in him. He didn't get loud or wobbly or maudlin when he drank, just nostalgic for the idealism of his youth. And even with all that, he was not particularly sentimental. He didn't pine for his stillborn revolution. He merely expressed a sadness for what he once glimpsed through a slightly open door, his dream of emancipation, of a liberated humanity, every man, woman, and child whole and complete. He approached it like it was an academic issue for him. But there was a lot of feeling behind his words. Words like his don't get expressed without a lot of feeling behind them. In Buck's case, as in Frank's, the words were fueled by the direct experience of a reality behind this one, and the certain knowledge that this one was flat and hollow by comparison. The direct experience of cosmic consciousness is something that can generate a lot of feeling. The rest is history. The dream is dead, murdered in its cradle. "But for a little while it was there," Frank told me on one of those boozy nights. "We could open that door for everyone, forever, or so it seemed. I still don't know what happened. It all got away from us so fast. Well, you know the story. You've read the books. Here it is 40 years later, and look at this ridiculous world we have. What would it look like instead if that door had been kept open? What would we be like after several generations? What would that look like? It wouldn't look like Woodstock or Haight-Ashbury. That was nothing. That was just a few crazy minutes of a history that was never written. The door has turned back into a wall now. Maybe it's just as well. Maybe it's better that people don't know." What a great cause to be on the losing side of. "It doesn't sound like my father," Lisa said as we walked the shoreline. "I knew he liked that book, Cosmic Consciousness, but I didn't know he had all these crazy ideas about revolution or anything." "It seems like something a man in his position might want to keep private," I say. "From his own family?" I don't respond. She knows I'm not the one to ask personal questions, so when I don't answer, she doesn't push. "Do you agree with him?" she asks. "About what?" "About the whole thing." "I don't see anything to disagree with. I mean, it has the air of a nutty conspiracy theory, but I don't see any specific error in your father's thinking. LSD is certainly everything he said it was. The facts are in on that once you look past the rabid vilification by Maya's ministry of propaganda and disinformation. Anyone capable of looking can see that for themselves. Mankind is certainly functioning at a very marginal level of consciousness, so the only direction is up. Clearly, there's an on-the-bus or off-the-bus element. So you did agree with him. As an exercise in dream state theory, it was fun, and it benefited the book. Beyond that..." I leave it hanging. "Beyond that, what?" "Beyond that, nothing. Except as it serves the book, I have very little interest in the matter. Your father understood that." "Oh, I forget," she says sarcastically. "It's all just a dream. Nothing is personal to you. Nothing really matters." We walk in silence for a few minutes. "I'm sorry to be getting testy," she says. "Say what you want. This is the time." "Okay, then. So isn't that right? Nothing matters to you? Nothing is important to you? Nothing is good or bad or better or worse?" I know this is all very personal for her, but she's right. Nothing is personal to me. If I had to choose between an age of enlightenment and an ice age, I'd have to flip a coin. It would be like going to a theater and choosing between two movies. The elevation of mankind to the left, and the extermination of mankind to the right. Both have their charms, and both would make for an amusing diversion, whether in real life or real life. But if confronted with such a choice, I'd probably decide not to see a movie and go for a walk instead. We stroll in silence for a few minutes before she speaks. So it was a failed revolution, the way my father saw it? In effect. He joked once that if you want to topple a superpower, you shouldn't send peaceniks and flower children to do it. He wanted the door opened. That was the objective. Free and easy access for everyone. It follows that the existing paradigm would be overturned. But that wasn't his main focus. I keep hearing this thing about free and easy access, she says. For everyone, I add. Free and easy inner access for everyone. That's how your dad phrased it. Okay, what's that about? I mean, why phrase it that way? It seems like a very deliberate wording, almost legalese. Your father came up with the phrase with several things in mind. It's very tricky to take a pro-drug position in this day and age, especially if the drug is as effectively demonized as acid, though technically I believe it's an agent, not a drug. Your father sought to head off the inevitable knee-jerk reactions whenever possible. Acid, she winces. Christ, I can't believe we're even talking about this. That's the kind of reaction he meant. He wasn't aware of any problem with LSD. He thought it was all good. Is it? I haven't found any problem. But as I told your dad, I wouldn't care if I did. Meaning what? Meaning, I pause, wanting to answer deliberately and correctly, here on the hard edge of things, that if I were the guy in charge of making this dream come true, I'd accept a very high casualty level. Just as if I were doing it for my own liberation, I'd be very risk-tolerant. Very. It's all just hypothetical, though. The actual downside appears to be negligible. But he was speaking in private with you. Why such cautious language? It's not like him to be so guarded. And you seem sympathetic to his views. I think he'd been writing a book in his head for decades. You might even find notes or drafts among his things. His ideas were pretty well developed. He used that particular phrasing to define a standard. He wasn't talking about a hippie renaissance or renewed government testing or more university studies. He was talking about unrestricted access to normally unavailable dimensions of selfhood. And the criteria he settled on as a clear standard was free and easy access for everyone. LSD happens to meet that standard, and nothing else does. Really? Nothing else? Your dad's phrase is clever in that it's very exclusionary. It excludes a lot of other drugs and agents and analogs. It also excludes other methods for achieving expanded states. For instance, there are Zen masters and meditation experts and spiritual gurus who claim that LSD is artificial and that their proprietary methods are the only true and real and lasting forms of inner access. Something like that. Is that a valid observation? I mean, would you know? I wouldn't presume to speak for their experiences, but I would say that they had their chance and never managed anything close to your father's stated ideal. In my opinion, free and easy access for everyone renders all religions and philosophies and spiritual teachings instantly obsolete and irrelevant and good riddance. It puts them out of a game they were never really in. And LSD really does that? I wasn't able to disprove it. And religious and spiritual groups find that threatening? Some, naturally. If chemical mysticism means you can drag any bum in off the street after breakfast and have him experiencing a full-blown state of God consciousness before lunch, then the rules have changed. The methods of access they're defending require decades of devotion, dedication, and privation, with no serious likelihood of success. Would you want to jump into a rowboat and start paddling across the Atlantic despite terrible hardship and struggle and the near certainty of failure? Or jump on a plane and be in Paris tonight? Anyway, your dad sidestepped the entire issue by defining the standard as free and easy access for everyone. When you put it that way, you instantly sweep everyone else off the table. It doesn't leave room for discussion or debate. What about the harmful effects you hear about? Of LSD? Neither of us were aware of any worth mentioning. Plenty of anecdotal reports, scare tactics, problems with disturbed or unbalanced people, with irresponsible usage, with use in non-conducive settings. There's no doubt we're talking about a very powerful substance, capable of completely revolutionizing someone's understanding of reality in a few hours. It's probably prudent to approach it with some respect. Really? Listen, I'm not an LSD expert or advocate. That's not my thing at all. But I'll say this. Of the many hours I spent in your dad's library, much of it was focused on the anti-LSD material, and I was very unimpressed. I have a very good nose for bullshit, and the anti-LSD material reeked of it. You are now the owner of that library, so you can look into it for yourself if you're interested, but I don't think you'll find much in the way of a downside to responsible LSD use except bad trips. But they can be pretty awful, can't they? I guess so. But that seems more a factor of your own internal environment and not the agent that got you there. Your father said you can't blame the key if you don't like what's on the other side of the door. Just to be clear, your dad wasn't talking about some new and exciting recreational activity we could add to our current list of diversionary pastimes. He wasn't talking about escapism in the way that drugs are used in the West. He was talking about reclaiming our sacred heritage. It's a little funny. In 1984, it talks about a society of peace, brotherhood, equality that could have been created, but wasn't. The earthly paradise had been discredited at exactly the moment when it became realizable. That's what your dad was talking about. An earthly paradise was his vision, and it was discredited exactly at the moment when it became realizable. We walk in silence. I think about these two versions of a transformed humanity I've looked at in the last few months. Bob's view that people can make this transition on their own through techniques and realization, and Frank's view that LSD is the key that can throw the door open for everyone. Bob's completely unfounded views are just a load of what Brett called happy bullshit, meant to calm spiritual stirrings and maybe turn a buck and strike a pose while doing it. Frank started with a utopian ideal based on Buck's book and did the courageous thing by following the facts wherever they led. Bob's idea is juvenile nonsense, and Frank's idea is at least plausible in theory. But what they have in common is that neither will ever come to pass. And it's not really desirable that they should. It's natural that we should want something better, but it doesn't necessarily follow that we know what that would be, or that we should have it. If I had to pick a winner in this contest of views, it wouldn't be Frank or Bob, but Lisa, Joe Banks, not Tim Leary or the Dalai Lama. One person making a break, drawing a line. That's where the best thing in the world happens, not in groups or in societies, but in individuals. It's interesting to note that Bob's views will probably be well received, and that Frank's balanced and heavily documented views would have caused him to be scorned out of his career and ostracized by society. Go, Maya. Why were you so focused on the negative material? Lisa asks. Weren't you trying to write about the golden key and the golden door and everything? No, not really. That was more your dad's thing. He wanted to construct some sort of quasi-academic document that would turn the world on its head. I don't need to be convinced, and I'm really not that interested. What's interesting to me is how quickly and effectively that door got slammed shut. That's Maya at work. That's what interests me. The raw power and cunning of fear. I'm not writing a book about how great expanded awareness is. There are plenty of those. I want to look at how great the enemy of awakening is. It's interesting to observe Maya in people, in ego, but it's been a real education to isolate and observe Maya's reaction to this very potent threat to her dominion. Not thousands of years ago, in a foreign land when no one wrote anything down, and you have to try to unravel an absurd mythology. But a few years ago, right here, and documented from every angle to the nth degree. It's been like this specialized branch of anthropology that focuses on understanding the ego and its fascinating talent for self-preservation. Fun for me, and good for the third book. All thanks to your dad. I'm starting to think he really was a bit of a crackpot. Maybe he was. But what I found in all this is that there were hundreds of so-called visionaries in this period, the 60s. But compared to your dad, they were mostly very small-thinking and short-sighted. I'm sorry your father never got to write Cosmic Consciousness too. I don't think it would have been well-received by the world, but that would be a reflection on the world, not your father. Or his subject. Lisa and I have talked about where she's going next, where her life will be taking her, who she's going to be from now on, and what it's going to be like. She has a curiosity about her future that ranges from anxious to excited. She's feeling homeless, which is something she's never felt before. She thinks the solution is to find a home. And I'm trying to help her see that the solution is getting comfortable with not having one. Or with being at home everywhere. She wants to get back to where she belongs and isn't happy to hear that there is no such place. Her dad and I talked about this sort of transcending into homelessness with regard to LSD and kids in the 60s. How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen God? After they've been God? Suddenly, people are being rocketed out of their mundane realities into phantasmagorical realms of hyper-awareness, setting themselves, in the process, adrift. Where do I go from here? Many must have asked themselves in quiet moments. I've destroyed one world, so now what? Obviously, I Don't go back to school to become an accountant or an engineer or a lawyer, now that I know, beyond any possibility of doubt, that what my parents call life is just cheap shadow play. So where do I go? They needed some understanding of this new level of reality they found themselves in, some framework within which to take refuge and assimilate their transpersonal, transhuman, trans-everything experiences. And they weren't finding any manuals of higher consciousness on Mom and Dad's bookshelves. They were catapulted so far beyond the paradigm of their parents that they were like a new and unprecedented order of beings. Leary's admonition to turn on, tune in, and drop out was fine as far as it went, which was exactly nowhere. Dropping out was the easy part. The hard part is that when you drop out of one thing, you have to drop into another. And there was no other thing. City parks and crash pads and Volkswagen buses do not make for an inhabitable paradigm. A new social strata of indigent mystics and sidewalk gurus was certain to not long endure. "It's a completely unique event in our history," said Frank. "Where else can you see anything remotely close in the annals of human consciousness? The genie got out of the bottle, and for a little while free and easy access for everyone was a reality. Not for long, but it was there. An emerging new religion with an authentic sacrament instead of a symbolic sacrament. But then the genie got crammed back into the bottle, and the bottle was labeled poison and buried so deep it might be many generations before it's seen again." One of the questions Frank and I played with was, "Where are they now?" Now we're looking back at the whole thing from the perspective of time. Where did they all go? "Back to the farm," we concluded. "Where else? They had to break back into the cuckoo's nest, reintegrate themselves into the combine, reassimilate themselves with the herd. Like Cypher, the traitor in the Matrix, they had to weasel their ways back in and make arrangements for their memories." Frank talked to me for 2 hours one night about memory and about how we are all historical revisionists in our own heads. I remember that at the time it sounded like the mutability of the past, Big Brother was able to impose on the citizens of Oceania. "Maybe Maya has the same thing," I remember thinking. "Or maybe I only think I remember thinking it." Not all the godlings underwent repatriation. Some found comfort and community in smaller satellite herds loosely united under the catch-all New Age banner. But that's just a petty vanity. All sheep in herd orbit, no matter how far out, are still part of the herd. Maya is the Good Shepherd, and few, if any, head were lost. "So here we are," said Frank, 4 decades later, looking back on it. "And what do we see? A few signs of impact in the old world, a few secondary revolutions, feminist, sexual, racial, but no new world ever sprang up out of it. It never took root. It never had a chance." Visionary Goofballs. Today, a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration, that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, that there is no such thing as death, life is only a dream, and that we are the imagination of ourselves. Here's Tom with the weather. Bill Hicks. Buck and Frank were both a bit goofy in their own ways. Buck envisioned a future of socialism, personal aircraft, the end of cities, and eventually, a race of morally superior people possessed of the cosmic sense, which he expected to develop in man over time, like color perception, becoming a race-wide faculty over a few thousand years. Buck was a friend and admirer of Whitman, but never went further than that. He never most honored Whitman's style. He most honors my style who learns under it to destroy the teacher. That's the finger pointing at the moon thing. Buck couldn't honor Whitman's style that way. He could only praise and admire the finger. Whitman was saying to the reader, to Buck, to us, this is your journey. Not I, not anyone else, can travel that road for you. You must travel it for yourself. Neither Buck nor Frank ever traveled that road. They both stopped. They both dug in and became self-appointed spokesmen for a journey they never took, making optimistic guesses and extrapolating futures they would never see. Were either of them right? I don't know. Ask me again in a few thousand years. Although neither of them knew it, the question they were trying to answer boils down to this. Can fear be replaced as the binding agent that holds the dream state together? Is there another core emotion of sufficient intensity to keep this whole thing lit up? And both these men, in their different ways, and without really understanding the question, said yes. Me? I don't think so. I know Maya pretty well, and I don't see her ever losing more than the occasional stray. A species-wide transformation is a pretty idea, but we have little cause for optimism and plenty for pessimism. It's nice to think we could elevate ourselves, and it's fun to dabble in theoretical scenarios, but the reality is that man will never evolve or transcend or develop beyond his past and present level. If that sounds like a bad thing to us, if Maya sounds like a force of evil, if the terms by which man lives on this planet seem too oppressive or restrictive, then we might do well to take a step back and reevaluate the situation. Where are we? What is this place? Is it a prison to be despised, or an amusement park to be explored and enjoyed? Is ego a hideous affliction, or is it simply the vehicle that allows us to come out and play? When the choice is between no self and false self starts looking pretty good, and despising and demonizing it starts to seem pretty ungrateful. Maybe there are other planes of existence, and maybe the inhabitants of those higher planes are of a more evolved, less benighted nature. Maybe this whole physical human plane is just the coarsest level of self-awareness, a kindergarten in that larger, subtler dreamscape. But that's not what Frank or Buck were talking about, and beyond the obvious mechanism of denial reasons, I don't know why anyone would care about the extended forecast anyway. Life isn't down the road in the distant mists of time. The game is afoot, here, now, on the physical human plane. Most people get through the day by believing that if they don't break too many rules, too much, they automatically get promoted up through the ranks, be it one life and straight to the top, or a climb of many smaller steps. This comes to us from Maya's Ministry of Deferral and Procrastination, which promotes a doctrine of plausible denial and applied non-aggression, and where the motto is, "Rock the cradle, not the boat." Lily Tomlin said the problem with being in the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat. To my way of thinking, the problem with being in the human race is that even if you win, you're still a human. Let's pretend for a moment that we're not, as a race, a mere tweak or two from perfection, but a cataclysmic makeover away. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that the way humanity is now is nowhere close to what it could be, that we're nowhere in the vicinity of what we might become, that we're morbidly mired at the shitty end of the potential spectrum. It certainly seems that the light of human consciousness is at its lowest possible setting and cannot be further dimmed. So at least there's cause for optimism. It can't get any worse. Maybe it just has to get a little brighter, just a smidge, and then some positive tipping point is reached, and the whole thing lights up like day, and these dark ages are only remembered for their slow dissolving steel and concrete. Man can crawl out of the lightless tar pits of religion and spirituality the way our distant ancestors crawled out of the oceans, and some version of Frank's crazy-ass new world could evolve, populated by integrated, empathetic, sympathetic, awake, aware, whole-brained, fully conscious, open-eyed, non-fear-based humans. I doubt it. But if it ever happens, it will only happen by getting people through that door that Frank saw. And there's no doubt that, in all of known creation, the only thing that might be called the Golden Key, that might offer free and easy access for everyone, is LSD. That is one of the two important lessons we can take from this psychedelic episode in our history. The 60s. We are, without a doubt, at the shitty end of the potential spectrum. Every Tom, Dick, and Mary got to travel the rest of the spectrum, and they took good notes, and that is what we learned. We don't have to be on the bus to understand this. We only have to visit any reasonably well-stocked library or bookstore and take an hour to see it for ourselves. There are higher ranges of consciousness open to us, and from there, the narrow range in which we live and die barely registers as consciousness at all. My assistants and proofreaders warn me that people don't like to hear themselves portrayed so negatively. That surprises me. I would think that most folks, if they took a minute to sit down and really think about it, would blubber in joyous relief to find out that what they've been calling life was really just the most meager level of subsistence, and that there were infinitudes more to this whole thing than they'd been led to believe. Just to give you the merest idea, think of all the time and effort and energy you put into projecting yourself into the world, into playing your role, into being you. Then, once you have some appreciation for what's involved, imagine not doing it anymore. Imagine if you could stop being you and just be. That's kind of a sideways way of saying something really central to this whole subject. How would your life be different if you didn't have to keep conjuring yourself into existence every moment and just exist? And on the other side of this coin, there's your obligation to reflect others back to them as they reflect you back to you. What if you broke this social compact of mutual ego assurance? What if you could just drop these two all-consuming activities? What if you withdrew all energy from the fictional character you play? And now, what if everyone did it? What then? The point Frank sought to impress upon me again and again, the point that he seemed to find most incomprehensible, most galling, was that those higher ranges of consciousness being denied to us are the very essence of who and what we are. They are our infinite and unbounded selves, and they are closed off to us at the very moment in history when they first became open to us. "That's all any of this is about," he'd often repeat. "Every culture in history has had their method of accessing the great within, but it was always restricted to the few, the elite, renunciates, shamans, and the like. But now, for the first time ever, we have it in our power to make it freely and easily available to everyone. Everyone. The most important event in the history of man. And what happens? The whole world rises up against it." Leaving us with the crop of methods we currently have, methods that Maya doesn't bother clamping down on because they pose no threat, that are, in fact, so ineffectual for their stated usage, and so perfectly suited to the perpetuation of delusion, that we can know without doubt from whose lineage they come down to us. Which brings us to the more important lesson the 60s have to offer. Maya. As impressive as we see she is when we bother to look, we are only seeing her at her most relaxed state. Facing no serious threats, she operates at only a minimal readiness level. She's like a sleeping giant who can do her job without being any more alert than those over whom she watches. But when an escape attempt is launched that has the potential to set the captives free in any serious numbers, an event we've only seen once, then the attentive observer is rewarded with a glimpse of what Maya is really capable. A very impressive sight. Bringing perhaps only a fraction of her offensive might to bear, she slammed the door shut, sealed it tight, plastered it out of visible existence, and labeled the area radioactively contaminated so the herd steers well clear, effectively turning humanity rabidly against the only thing that might, with a straight face, be called a practicable road to salvation. LSD provided the one and only serious offensive assault against Maya, and without much fuss or bother, she rose to the challenge and quelled the uprising, swatting it like a bug, and settling back into her light doze. She villainized, demonized, and criminalized the entheogenic class of substances so effectively that here we are now, a few decades later, and all that can really be said of mankind's one chance for liberation is that a hole in the wall was brought to the attention of the warden and promptly repaired. A young country with boundless idealism, poetic vision, and virtually limitless wealth, burning with words like freedom and expansion and exploration, with phrases like all men are created equal and inalienable rights and pursuit of happiness. That's a place, said Frank, where good things could happen. Accept an act of rebellion, he asked. It's a revolutionary decree, a response to what it calls an absolute tyranny. It's a declaration of war. Where's that spirit today? It doesn't exist. I'm proof of that. If I never stood up and said something, who will? We are a vanquished, broken people. We are slaves. That's how he talked sometimes. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, he continued, lifting his glass, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government. Declaration of Independence? I asked. He nodded solemnly with a muffled belch. Revolution is the overthrow of a tyrannical oppressor. Whether individually or collectively, it is the ultimate expression of discontent. Revolutions start small and rely, perforce, on guerrilla tactics. They begin with treasonous plotters meeting in barns and back rooms. The enemy faced by these uppity peasants consists of established governments, standing armies, courts, established order, fearful family, the press, and an intelligence apparatus capable of rooting out insurgency before it moves beyond the pitchfork and bird gun stage. Of course, when it's just a conflict between oppressed citizens and their oppressive governments, or between inmates and prison staff, that's merely the dream state shadow of the real process of revolution. The personal declaration of independence. The individual bid for freedom. The one true war of which all others are but shadows. If you were the tyrannical oppressor, it would be your job to avoid an uprising and maintain order. That's not really very difficult because we, the people, actually want to be oppressed. We just don't want it to get so uncomfortable that we'd prefer death to continued oppression. The art and science of tyrannical oppression is to bind the spirit, but not so much that death becomes preferable to continued bondage. As America's founding fathers knew, it's easy to keep people from choosing death. All experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. U.S. Declaration of Independence. In Frank's entheogenic revolution, however, it's not so much a matter of the current regime being insufferably oppressive as it is of the new regime being so mind-bogglingly superior that present conditions seem like life in a coffin by comparison. That's why the little revolution of the 60s sputtered and died. Not because Maya is invincible, but because desire is a very weak agent of change. And if we can understand why that doomed it from the start, we can also understand why any attempt to launch a personal revolution pulled by desire rather than pushed by insufferable discontent is similarly doomed, and why Frank's revolution failed and Lisa's succeeded. Personal revolution is fueled by emotional energy of the purest intensity. That intensity comes from focus, and that kind of focused emotional energy doesn't look like love or tranquility or compassion. It looks like seething, rage, or severe psychosis. It's an ugly fact of an ugly business, but that's how it works. Suicidal discontent. That's how revolutions are won, and that's why they so seldom are. Rockets aren't launched into space on chanting and prayers, and escaping the ego's gravity requires an equivalent amount of explosive force. We have to take all the emotional energy we normally blast out in 1,000 directions to keep our dream state characters animated and focus it on a single point. It's all or nothing. This is the kind of stuff Frank and I discussed now and then. He'd spent his life quietly wondering where his beloved revolution went wrong, how the LSD-based transcendence of the species he'd watched unfolding ended up failing so miserably. I know he came to understand the whole thing better by discussing it with me, but I don't think that made him any happier about it. The way he saw it, the war was over. The good guys lost, and history is written by the winners. Standard religions and belief systems, whether orthodox or unorthodox, mainstream or wacko, serve to keep the herd together and heading slowly nowhere in an orderly manner. Whether we believe in something or believe we don't believe in anything makes no difference. All beliefs are the same belief. There is only the herd. There are always those who aren't content within the herd and seek something more than mindless plodding and grazing and humping. They peel themselves away and form sub-herds that travel apart, but alongside, independent in belief and appearance only. There are also the occasional stragglers and strays, but the trick to keeping loose stock with the herd, the Good Shepherd knows, is to let them stray. They won't go far. Where would they go? What is commonly thought of as the herd is really just the core herd. There is a larger, more scattered herd that becomes visible as our elevation increases and our perspective broadens. Those at the outermost fringes, to the sides or far out front, are no less a part of the herd than those at the heart. They're just indulging in a bit of egoic self-gratification. Draw back far enough, and we see that everyone is plodding in the same aimless direction at the same shuffling pace, and that the idea of a radical or a revolutionary or a bold explorer is nothing more than a petty conceit. There are no explorers. There is no spirit of exploration. There is no courage. There is no freedom or love of freedom. There is only the herd. Every once in a while, a single beast does leave the herd. Never a group or even a pair. Where there's more than one, there's the herd. They only go, when they go, one at a time. And where do they go? Over the edge, of course. Where else? There are only two choices, the herd and over the edge. There is only the herd, and there is no herd. I've said that when I was young, I never found anyone I would have wanted to be like. Not only didn't I know anyone, I didn't know of anyone. There was no success that looked like success to me. There was no accomplishment that seemed worth the bother. The only thing I ever remember thinking might be a good way to spend a life was as a failed poet, kind of like the village idiot, but without the civic responsibilities. The idea of being a successful poet held no charm, but being a failure as a poet had a nice feel to it. A one-man revolution, certain to fail, but for a good cause. Anyway, as I think about it now, I think I like what Frank and Buck did, or almost did, or tried to do, or thought about doing, with their lives and with their wise, foolish, impossible dreams. They were failed poets in the way that I mean it, and if my life had gone another way, I think I would have been content to be like them.